The Sports Interview with Anne Liguori podcast is brought to you by iBeCool Luxury Athleisure Wear for Men and Women, featuring the exclusive ice-fill cooling technology, along with SPF 50 plus sun protection. Look your best. Protect your skin. Visit ibkul.com to learn more. Welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and my guest is Warren Botke, PGA Master Professional and known for training Brooks Koepka in junior development years when Brooks was age 10 through 18. Welcome to the show, Warren. It's always great to connect with you.
Great. Thank you so much, Anne. I always look forward to being around you and your show and all the great things that you do.
Thank you. And congratulations on being named Golf Digest Best Teacher in Florida for 2022 to 2023. But this is your 12th straight year for this honor. So this is old hat to you.
Well, yeah, but I never take it for granted. There's so many new up and coming great instructors that come out with all the new technology. I'm just so excited and happy at age 66. I'm still relevant.
You know, I was going to ask you that. It must be satisfying to be recognized time and again. They're not forgetting the teaching professionals like yourself who've been around for a while.
Well, this is my fourth decade. And I've been very, very fortunate. I've trained about 25 different tour professionals. I've had winners in the LPGA, the Champions Tour, the Nike Tour, which is Korn Ferry now, and on the PGA Tour. And just have so many upcoming new juniors that are playing in HAGA events and Division I school and looking to get on mini tours.
So how much anticipation is there for, you know, a pro like yourself waiting to see if you again make the Golf Digest list, which you've done so often in your career? But I mean, what do you wait around and wait till the issue comes out or the digital version, or what's it like to wait and see if you're picked?
Well, it's, you know, again, it's you do what you do because you love what you do. It's the passion. It's not about awards and accolades. It's your peers. There was 2000 golf instructors and coaches that pull this list together, and you vote on your peers and they see the value of who you are. So it's not a popularity contest where you might have 800 members and they all vote for you and try to push the needle. So it's even more rewarding when you see people in the trenches that do the same work you do and they feel like you're relevant and you know, that you're still on your game, if you will.
So it's actually voted on by your peers, which is probably the highest accolade you can have, right?
That's correct. Yeah. When you have people that are in the industry and know, there's no way it can be kind of slated where you have a bunch of people trying to, you know, jockey for votes from other outside agencies.
So when did you start your golf career?
Wow. I started my career when I was 11 years old. I was a caddy in New York, a place called Putnam Country Club in Mayapack, New York. And I was befriended by the pro there, Joe Longo, and he helped me around and showed me a little bit about the game. And then I moved from there to Westchester, Pennsylvania. A gentleman, Harry Hammond, got me involved in golf, and I caddied and worked in the shop. He worked on my game. And then at age 19, I was going to go to school, but there weren't that many schools, and I wasn't really great and good enough to really have a golf scholarship. And at that point, there wasn't that many in 1974. So I ended up getting in the golf business and started to play some tournaments, tried to play as a Monday Rabbit on the PGA Tour, and realized these guys are really good. So I enjoyed always coaching and being around people and having relationships. And this is my 48th year of teaching golf.
And how did you get down to Florida?
Well, I knew if this was going to be what I wanted to do, and this was going to be my full-time profession, I wanted to move down to where the golf mecca was. And Palm Beach County, as well as South Florida, is that. And we have almost 200 golf courses down in that area. And I figure if I'm going to be, doing something that I want to do year round, I can't live in New York or Pennsylvania 6 months a year. So I made a move back in 1984, and I've been down here, you know, 37 years, and I just love it, enjoy it, and never look back.
And how many years have you been at PGA National?
I've been at PGA National for 7 years. And then prior to that, I opened up and helped develop Abacoa Golf Club and had a golf academy there. And I was there 17 years.
Wow. So, and you're known for being Brooks Koepka's junior development coach. He was 10 years old when you first started coaching Brooks Koepka, four-time major winner. How did you and Brooks connect?
Well, it was through his dad. I knew his dad. His dad was a very good golfer. So I knew his dad, Bob, before I even knew Brooks was even born. And, you know, he was a 3 handicap, got him down to scratch. And he saw the value of what, you know, I was able to do with him. And about age 10, one day he called me and he says, "Hey, we got to talk. I want you to take Brooks over. You've given me all the things I know I can teach him, but I think he needs to go to another level." So I worked with Brooks for almost 8 years to 18 when he went to college and he went to Florida State. And that was like 6 hours away, so it was tough to be involved. But, you know, we always continue to communicate through emails and texts and phone calls. And to this day, we're very friendly.
And what was he like when you first saw his golf game at the age of 10?
Well, he had some good basic fundamentals because I knew Bob told him what I told him. So I knew it was a kind of a carbon copy of that. And then we were just able to build from that. So he had a little bit of a foundation from what his dad, and then he played a lot of Palm Beach County Junior golf with Donna White and Bobby Brown. And those guys kind of helped him a little bit, but, you know, we got him back into what we call one plane swing and got him into a different type of a golf swing there that was easy, maintenance free. And to this day, he uses it. He uses a lot of the things that I've taught him. The main thing that he says is PGA, posture, grip, and alignment. Those three things are 80% of the golf swing. If you address the ball, hold the club right, and align your body correctly, there can't be too many things that are going to go wrong.
You make it sound so easy. And Brooks makes it look so easy.
Yes,
so,
he does.
So when did you know that he had the potential to be a great player?
Well, it was, you know, from 10 to 14, that's the developmental stages. You have the maturation of kids where they go through their pre-puberty and get different things and so on. And I could see around 15, he started to get focused. Brooks is very stoic. He's very quiet, very shy. So he doesn't show his emotions as much. And today he really doesn't that much. And people think he has a chip on his shoulder. It's just that his personality. And it was when he was 15 years old, almost 16, he went to a AJGA tournament in Dothan, Alabama, and he ended up winning that. He shot 69-72, won his first AJGA event, and that was something where it got me a little flicker in my eye where I thought, wow, this guy's really starting to develop. He can hang with the bigger kids and be able to do that. The following year, as his junior year in high school, he won the Florida State High School Golf Championship individually. And to do that in the state of Florida, there's a lot of good players. And that was when that turning point was like, wow, this guy's really going to be great. And I always told him, I said, you're going to play the tour. You're going to play the PGA Tour. You're good enough because I have coached so many different players on there. I saw that pathway. And I said, if you stick with it, you can do this. And he still talks about that in interviews and so on.
And how old was he when you said that to him?
Almost 17. Right before, you know, after he won that high school championship, I said, we're going to get you in college. And he wasn't really sought out by too many colleges, but Florida State offered him a program. And he was an All-American, I believe, his sophomore year and then also his senior year, an All-American. And then he went over to Europe. He played the Challenge Tour over there. He won 3 times. And then he got his tour card in Europe. Because of his tour card in Europe, he got his standing, his world ranking. He got a couple invitations to play in United States. He got on the tour by winning enough money to keep his card. Then he ended up winning the Turkey Open in Europe. He ended up winning his first PGA Tour win, the Southwest, or the Waste Management, excuse me, back in, I think it was 2016, and then the rest was history.
Was it your idea, Warren, or his idea to go to Europe and start playing professionally over there?
It was pretty much his idea and his agent. He signed with an agent and his parents talked to him and they bounced things off me periodically and said, what would you think? But I thought it was a great idea. It was a different path to go. And he became very, very successful. And since then, his brother tried to do the same thing, Chase. I worked with him for about 4 years. Chase and Brooks are completely different individuals. Brooks is a field player. He's very tactile, where Chase is very technical. He likes the track man and he likes all the bells and whistles and all the angles. And I don't really teach that as much in that kind of a way. So we didn't connect as long as we did with Brooks. Brooks liked my style of coaching better.
You said Brooks was very stoic back then when he was a kid, and he still is, obviously. He doesn't give much away as far as emotions go. And that's, to me, one of his biggest strengths. I mean, you just never know what he's thinking. He doesn't look like he lets his emotions get the best of him, although he's probably sometimes just cringing inside when he's not living up to his own expectations. But did that kind of hint to you that this guy was special when you saw how he handled his emotions as a young man?
Yeah, when, you know, I could see when he took a double bogey, it wasn't as of a high and it wasn't as much of a low, depending on if he made birdie or double bogey. You really couldn't read when he was coming up 18, whether he was four under or four over. And that's the way he was. He just kind of was wired that way. His dad's kind of the same way. So he was kind of a chip off the old block in that way. Yeah, not too many highs, not too many lows. But, you know, as a coach, you get the relationship, and we had a great relationship. I was like his second dad. And one day he came in for a golf tournament when he was about 16, and he was a little down. And I said, "Hey, what's going on?" He said, "Oh, man, I just got a speeding ticket, but don't tell my dad." I'm like, "Hey, buddy, don't worry about it, man. You know, it's what happens with you and me stays here." You know, so that's the kind of relationship we had. And it's just been fun. It's been great. And he's like a son to me. I only have two daughters, but just the times that we've had together were very special.
Well, from a mental perspective, and then I want to go over swing for a second, but, you know, it always impressed me when I've covered every major title that he's won, and it always amazed me how he never complained about anything. You'd hear the other players, particularly at the US Open of Shinnecock, complain about the speed of the greens and how crazy difficult the course is set up for the US Open. And Brooks never complained. He never, ever said anything negative about the golf course. He just basically went out and focused and played his own game. And I just think that was so important. He didn't let, you know, the challenges of the course become a distraction. And whereas some of the other players just would voice how difficult these US Open conditions were. And, you know, when I saw him at Erin Hills, the US Open, the same thing. It was just very, very focused and basically kept, you know, the distractions to a minimal.
Yeah, I mean, he just knows that it's going to be a tough tournament. He mentally prepares differently for majors. That's why people are like, why does this guy do so well in majors? And he always works differently in the sense that he prepares differently. He knows it's going to be a tough thing. He's ready to take on any kind of challenge. He always prepares his body, and his team is with him. He has his chef and his caddy, and they have meetings and they talk about, you know, a game plan. And it's just like an NFL coach. You go in there the week before, you look at the films, you see what your opposition is, and he kind of handles it that way. And he never really complains, "Hey, geez, the greens were bumpy or the grass was high in the rough." And because he knows 148 players or 156 players have the same things. And then he goes and you've probably heard and seen the interview where he says, "I have 156 players. I know half of them are not going to make the cut." And then it goes down to 78. And then the 78 of half of those people, I know I can beat. And then it goes down to the 38 of those people, and I know I can do this. And he whittles it down to where he can only have to beat 8 or 10 people. And that takes a lot of pressure off you. And some looked at it like, "Gee, that's kind of cocky," but it was just, it was kind of looking at the numbers. I've always told him, and he's always believed in this, that, you know, there's a difference between cocky and confident in addiction. Right. They're very, very close. Know the difference. You know, you tell somebody how cocky you are, you're talking about yourself and your ability. When you're confident, your clubs and your actions will take care of that action. You don't have to tell it.
I always defended Brooks Koepka. I loved when he said what you had just said, that quote. I was there when he said it. And, you know, if you don't believe that, if you don't believe you're the best, then you can't be the best. So there's that fine line between, you know, being confident and voicing that confidence and kind of sharing his reasoning too. I thought it was fascinating to hear, you know, how he basically analyzed the scenario of being, you know, the best. And there's a fine line between that confidence and being arrogant. And you're right. A lot of people took it the wrong way.
Yeah, totally. You, no one needs to hear. And there's guys out there that toot their own horn. And that's just an insecurity and a fear when they start doing it. They're trying to talk themselves off the ledge. But if you do your preparation, which he does, and, you know, his body, his workout, his mental physique, his physical physique, he knows he's prepared. He's confident going in that I'm going to play well.
You know, he won the U.S. Open in 2017, 2018. We talked about that. Aaron Hills and then Shinnecock. Then the PGA Championship in 2018, 2019. As you say, he was second at the Masters in 2019. He was on a roll. I mean, I just thought he was going to keep going because, I mean, he just seemed just unstoppable in these major championships. And then injuries happened. How has he been able to get through the injuries physically and mentally?
Well, seeing, I talked very little to him during that time because, you know, you let somebody take, you know, their time and let them go through it. I've always been an encouragement and always would send a text or encourage him, hey, I'm thinking of you, things like that, but not to bother him, but let him mend. But the injuries, you know, some were saying, was it self-induced in a sense? Was it too much gym work? Was it this? Was it that? And I think the jury's still out on some of it. He worked very, very hard, but he's changed his regimen now to where he wants to be an athlete. He's not trying to do it as a golfer. And you have different muscle groups and things like that. So if he can handle himself athletic and be all around strong versus then drilling into certain muscles and trying to make them golf muscles strong, that's where the injuries were happening. Trying to do too many squats, the knees, the ankles, the Achilles tendon, which wasn't him, but I was thinking of Tiger. These are the things that have happened. A freak thing with a thumb. I mean, it's just been a couple little crazy things, but it isn't, I don't think, so much working so hard, but he's got a different trainer and a different regimen and a different attitude where I want to look and feel athletic. I don't want to be a golf specimen, if you will.
Right. I think that's so important because I think some of these guys obviously overtrain and put too much stress on their body. And that's that's totally a detriment. And, you know, it's one thing to be strong and in great shape when you're playing golf, but you don't want to put that stress on these muscles. You're doing enough as you walk every day and practice every day and play this game. I mean, you know, it's just, there's a fine line with training as well.
Correct. Correct. Definitely. And I think too, he was taking it a little bit too much in the sense where he was working out. His diet was just so crazy. He had like a 3% body fat. And it was just like, you know, why don't you enjoy life a little bit? That's not going to be the thing that's going to take you over the top. Your mind is, let's make that strong, not your body.
So Warren, does his swing look similar now to how it did when you were with him in his early years?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, it hasn't really changed that much. I have a video of age 10 or 11 that somebody had and sent me, and looking at it today, if you put them side by side, they're really not that different other than a couple adjustments we made, keeping it, like I said, on a one plane. And then his wrist flexion is a little bit more flatter where it was a little more cupped. But, you know, Claude had said after he worked with him, and he said, what you guys did and what it was easy because I just had to maintain what you guys built. It wasn't like I retrained and redeveloped the whole swing. And he's a big guy. He works big muscles, and the big muscles control the golf ball and the golf club. He doesn't use a lot of hands. His body is strong. That's why he likes his body to be strong, because that's the power into the ball.
What about his golf swing makes him so good? Would you say that power, or you said he's a very, you know, handsy feel kind of player. So is it a combination of the power and the feel?
Yeah, he's got an incredible touch. For guys that usually hit the ball far, you know, they're not gifted both ways where they can really touch around the greens. He's a great putter. He's got good short game, and through Pete Cowan's skills in the short game is what's really helped him develop that. And I mean, he's the complete package. And that's the reason why the results are where they are. He's finished second in two other majors. So, I mean, he really could have had six majors.
And you believe he'll continue to win major titles?
I think so. He made a statement, and I concur to it in the sense he said he's going to win 10 majors. Now, he's just turned 31 years old. Let's give it 15 years to 46. You know, 15 years, if you win one every other year, I mean, that puts him right to 10. So it isn't unrealistic, and it's not a cocky statement. I just think confidence-wise, if I think the Golf Channel did something where they, the past six or seven majors, they did how many under par, and he was like 85 under par, and the next person was 29 under. So it was incredible, incredible stat.
Phenomenal stat. Unbelievable. What did you think of the match? Brooks Koepka really wanted to beat Bryson DeChambeau badly, and he did.
Yeah, I watched it. I haven't spoken to him or anything like that. It was a lot of hype. And as you are in the media, I think it's not as exaggerated as it was in the sense that they hated each other. I think, you know, after playing a Ryder Cup and just drilling the European team 19-9, I mean, they interacted and they did some things. I think they keep their space and, you know, they're very civil to each other, but I don't think it's a situation they don't like each other totally. But the match was, it was incredible. He didn't play, I didn't think his best off the tee. He scattered a few shots, but he hit the ball well on his approach shots, and he putted him unbelievable. And I mean, Bryson didn't even win a hole. I mean, it was, I didn't expect that, but he drummed them pretty well. And I thought it was a little comical that at the end in the interview, Bryson's like, "Hey, we'll do a rematch." And Brooks just looked at him and said, "That's not happening. This isn't a heavy bit, a heavy weight bout in boxing where you get rematches. It's a once and done. He has all to lose and nothing to gain. He beat him and that's it."
It was all about just crushing him. You could tell that's all Brooks Koepka wanted to do. He didn't even think about perhaps, you know, trash talking or being that compelling for television. It, you know, it was not that compelling. Say what you want about their feud, but the interest from that feud certainly did not spill over to the golf course in terms of trash talking and funny one-liners. It you know, from that standpoint, it wasn't that compelling, but Brooks played pretty well.
Yeah, and you know, he felt very comfortable. Obviously, Chase, his brother, it was on the bag. It made it very simple that way. And Phil Mickelson and Charles Barkley tried to poke the stick in the hornet's nest a few times and needle him and stuff. And he just didn't take it. You know, he just stayed focused and took care of business.
Well, I hope the social media feud has ended, because I personally thought that social media feud between Brooks Koepka and Bryson DeChambeau was distracting for both players. And I did think it did affect their play. And it's as we were talking before, I mean, Brooks is always so focused and just one tracker as far as just thinking about the course and winning and getting business done. But I really do feel that with all the hoopla around the feud on social media, it was very distracting to both players. They, during the height of that feud, they really didn't win any majors.
No, not at all. Right. So it's hard to say how much of a distraction that was or not. You try to believe that they didn't take it personally, but I think inside a little bit, it hurts, you know, that somebody's trying to, you know, degrade you or taint your reputation a little bit. So never voiced it, never said anything about it publicly or personally, but I'm sure it hurt a little bit. But, you know, he's a strong-willed, solid rock personality kind of guy, and he just doesn't really care.
Brooks had said in quotes, "Warren is the real reason I'm into golf. He is a mentor. I enjoy spending my time learning from him." I mean, you can't get a better compliment, you know, as a instructor and as a teacher and as a coach than that, right, Warren? And if you look back on all the years you spent with Brooks Koepka, what's the single best tip you ever taught him, do you think?
Well, first of all, that gets me, you know, kind of emotional when you read that, because I know he said it and stuff like that. And I just felt like I did my job as a coach and was paid for it and so on. But we went deeper than that. And that's why he said what he said from his heart. But, you know, I think the biggest one tip that, you know, I always told them was, you know, make sure when you stand up to the ball that you feel comfortable and you're committed, and go through your pre-shot routine, your PGA. Make sure you have a good posture. You make sure your grip and you feel comfortable and your aim, and then let it go. And he talks about PGA all the time because people ask him, what is the biggest thing that you learned? And it was the most simplest thing that he learned, an acronym like PGA.
Posture, grip, and alignment. Just keep it simple, right? Just
It is the Gilchrist method, right? Keep it simple, stupid. You know, we like to just not make it too complicated. And, you know, we have the best cameras. We got the best equipment, technology, TrackMans, flight scopes, bells, whistles. And you know what? Golf hasn't gotten any easier. And we have, so what it does, and the USGA had said it, they said, it is a difficult game. We've tried everything we can come up, you know, with better balls, better shafts, better club heads, and it doesn't get any easier. But ultimately, it's an individual sport with a mind game, and you got to put the ball in the hole.
And what would you say is the single best tip you ever taught him involving his mental game?
I would say the mental game was, we talked a little bit about one hole at a time, one shot at a time. You know, it's kind of like spilled milk. When you spill the milk on the table, you can't put the milk back in the carton. So you wipe up and you move on, and you don't let one hole bother you. It's done. You can't fix anything. So I always try to tell them one hole at a time, one shot at a time.
Can you talk, Warren, about golf teaching life lessons? What in golf transfers over to life?
Well, I think the first thing that people, you know, like about when they meet me, when we have an opportunity to meet for the first time, is the relationship. I mean, a lot of people, when they come at different levels, their golf game is very dear and near to them. On the professional side, that's what they do for their life. So you got to be very, very careful you don't break someone down. And then someone from a beginner, they're scared. They've never been on with a coach. They've never had a golf lesson. So they're petrified. So in both of those cases, I try to calm them and say, hey, look, we're going to just take a look at this. We're not going to make a lot of changes. Build that relationship, feel that safety area where there's a safe zone and they feel safe around the environment. And then I can kind of whittle away and work with the individuals.
What about on the golf course? Any major lesson? I know there's millions of lessons you learn on the golf course that really transfers over to life lessons. But if you had to pinpoint the biggest thing that you or any player can learn on the golf course that they can use in life, what do you think that would be?
Well, you know, life is difficult. It can be at times. It has its ups and downs. The golf game has its ups and downs. And you just got to take one shot at a time. And I think the biggest thing is expectations. Unmet expectations equals frustration. And that's been kind of a quote I've been telling all my players at all levels. If you would go out there and expect to shoot 68 and you shoot 77, you're going to be frustrated. And then if you go out there, expect to break 100 and you shoot 110, you're going to be, you know, frustrated. So try to get a game plan. Try not to put a number on it. Just take one shot at a time. And I, you know, for a beginner golfer or somebody that's a relatively new to the game, I try to have them break 100 for the first time. Do very little, you know, side goals where we just do little short-term goals. When we see the momentum of the short-term goals being achieved, then we can launch a long-term goal.
And what about for players whose handicaps are perhaps between 10 and 14? What would your advice be to them?
Well, what we do is an assessment, right? I had a guy the other day, he went from a 7 to a 2, and another gentleman from a 4 to a plus 1. And those guys are different guys. They're wired different. But what we had to do is drill down and find out where are they missing 3 to 5 shots in a round of golf. And it could be your approach shots, you know, maybe your wedges. The closest wedge you ever hit when you're in the fairway is 17 feet. Well, we need to get it 5 feet. You're putting too much stress on your putter. So we kind of really have to do an assessment and see where is there a leakage in the game that's costing them 3 to 5 shots in a round.
Final question, Warren. When you look back at the year 2021, what would be your favorite golf moment?
I would have to say 21 is the Ryder Cup. I mean, it was really hyped up. I didn't expect a, you know, a drilling like they did. I knew they would win. But 19-9, I think it's the largest margin that, that in the history of the Ryder Cup. And that was really, really a surprise. And to, you know, to see that team and what other teams are going to be behind that. We have a, I would say, a group of about 20 golfers right now in a younger age group, let's say late 20s, early 30s, that could be around for a while. And I don't see the European Tour having that, you know, area of where they have a strong bench. And I'm not saying they're not good players. There's a lot of great players over there, but these are exceptional golfers that we have right here. And I think that's going to be something that we're going to see a little bit of a history or an era where we might win three or four Ryder Cups in a row.
Yeah, it really was a really compelling year between Phil Mickelson winning the PGA Championship at his age and Hideki Matsuyama earning his first major title. And, you know, as you say, the Ryder Cup and a lot of these incredible women showcasing their skills in the LPGA. You know, it really was a great year for golf. And I want to thank you, Warren, for everything you do for golf. It's such a pleasure to know you. And you know, I just have always been a huge admirer of Koepka's style, you know, as far as his golf swing and his mental approach to the game. And you were so important in his development at that early age. And I congratulate you because your work is just phenomenal.
Well, thank you so much, Anne. Thank you for all you do in golf and the way you get your message out to so many people. We really appreciate you. And I look forward to seeing you at the Honda Classic.
Thanks so much, Warren. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Anne. Talk to you soon.
The Sports Interview with Anne Liguori podcast was brought to you by IB Cole Luxury Athleisure Wear for Men and Women, featuring the exclusive IceFill cooling technology along with SPF 50 plus sun protection. Look your best. Protect your skin. Visit IBKOL.com to learn more.